final version, because that's the one that's going to go.
Good morning, everyone. We're going to go ahead and call the Senate Committee on Judiciary to order. This morning, we have a couple of bills that are before us. I'm going to start with the work session on Senate Bill 1007.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1007 comes to you from the Senate Judiciary Committee. You have the dash for amendments in front of you. Just came out this morning. We also have in your packet the other amendments, too. Let me go through the dash for if I can. We start off with Section 1. That's a statement of current law. It's RS 421-121, and it basically establishes 30% earned time for those who are eligible for earned time. We go over to page 2 of the bill, and it says, notwithstanding subsection A of the section, the maximum amount of time credits earned of the section may not exceed 20%. Then in subsection 2B, starting on line 7, the section applies the total term of incarceration as opposed to criminal action in which the party stipulates, or the inmate is convicted of an offense that was committed less than 5 years after the inmate completed serving a sentence. And completed serving a sentence includes not only time served, but also probation, post-prison supervision. And then for those within that category, the crimes that apply are a person felony, and that's as determined by the rules and regulations of the Criminal Justice Commission, and then a crime described in paragraph E. And then we go down to see the inmate is also convicted of a person felony. So you basically have, you're excluded if you've had a crime within 5 years that fits within a particular category. You're also excluded if you then commit a whole series of crimes that you'll see starting on line 16 through the next page. And those lists are exactly the same. So the list for the exclusion for the 5-year look back is the same as a list for the exclusion for the crime committed. So if you are standing before the court charged with one of these crimes in addition to a mandatory minimum sentence, you are not eligible for the additional 10%. If you had committed one of these crimes plus a mandatory minimum sentence, basically Measure 11 or gun crime, you're not ineligible for the additional 10%. Does not impact current law as it relates to 20%. Chair, members of the committee, going over to page 3, it defines what a completed sentence is. It describes what a person felony is. Chair, members of the committee, going over to page 4, we're now talking about operative dates. The amendments to Section 421-121 by the section become effective on July 1, 2011. The amendments to 421-121 by Section 1 of the section apply to the inmates who are sentenced for a crime committed after July 1, 2011 and before January 1, 2013, who are not otherwise prohibited from obtaining these sentences. Once again, a Measure 11 crime. Chair, members of the committee, Section 3 is a sunset provision. Then going over to page 6, the amendments to 421 by Section 3, this act become operative on January 1, 2013. And that will bring us back to the law. It basically eliminates the 10% earned time. It will take us back to before last session. Then, Mr. Chair, members of committee, Section 5 and 6 are conforming language, and let me go further over to page 11. And that we're now talking in Section 7, how this would work out in the courts. The court has entered, for example, when does this apply? It applies if the court has entered a supplemental judgment or the court pursuant to Section 7B has ordered in the record in open court that the court, in the Department of Corrections, may consider the inmate for reduction in terms of incarceration. If the court has not done that at this stage, this bill will apply, part of it will apply upon passage, then they're not eligible. So unless they've gone to court, and unless there's been a supplemental judgment or an order in open court, then, for example, after the effective date of this bill, if someone were eligible before the effective date, they don't get a court hearing. Chair, members of the committee, going further on through the bill to Section 8, the Department of Corrections may not make notification in this bill or any of the effective date, may not consider an inmate sentence before July for a reduction term of incarceration that exceeds 20% unless before the effective date of this 2010 Act. so that have to consider before that. Then we get down to Section 9, and this is a new provision, and this will be the Secretary of State shall conduct an audit of earned time credit programs described in 421-121, which is basically this bill. The audit shall include an assessment of the Department of Corrections compliance with statutory law and department's rules, policies, and procedures, and then an evaluation of the actual potential impact on the program, including the evaluation of the program's financial impact, the impact on the program on recidivism and public safety. So, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, there are basically two audits. One, has the Department of Corrections followed its own rules and regulations as it relates to people earning earned time? So do they actually earn it? And then the second part, which would be how effective is it? And this, that's basically, they'll do as they did in the state of Washington and other states, is an analysis of the literature, evidence-based practices, literature, to see, okay, what we're doing in earned time is similar to what other states are doing, and then from that you extrapolate as to the effectiveness of reduction of recidivism. And the studies that I have read recently basically show that earned time does reduce recidivism rates. Now, obviously, if you release a whole group of people from prison, some of them are going to commit crime, as the Washington State study said, and the crime rate will go up. They also said if you want to eliminate crime totally, you put everyone in prison. So that's the push and the pull in that particular one. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, on the last page of the bill, Section 9 of this act is repealed in 2011. This act is an emergency clause in Section 1. Chairman, that's a rough translation of the amendments.
Senator Roland Meachie.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I move that we adopt the Dash 4 amendments to Senate Bill 1007.
Senator Roland Meachie moves the adoption of the Dash 4 amendments in Senate Bill 1007. Discussion. Chair is going to start off with, I want to lay some framework here as to what we have before us and try to give maybe a little bit broader explanation than what committee staff has been able to put forward based on the technical language. First of all, I want to go back to House Bill 3508, which is the bill that was passed in 2009 that included the 10% additional earned time for eligible inmates within the program of earned time. As everyone realizes, at the time that we were asked, there are four of us that were asked to meet and to come up with a plan to be able to save additional money out of the Department of Corrections so we could buy back other critical public safety services. Some of those services included maintaining 24/7 state troopers on the roads, forensic analysis and lab work to be done, state police detectives, maintaining the Oregon Youth Authority at Hillcrest by not having 72-plus beds closed, ensuring that the Youth Authority facility that's in Eastern Oregon and Burns stayed open, that we needed to realize additional savings. It was projected that we would save approximately $6 million from the implementation of the extra 10% earned time. My understanding is that it has been demonstrated that we have realized somewhere between $4 and $5.5 million, understanding that from what I've been told by LFO and from the Department of Corrections at this point, during this continuation of this biennium, that we would not realize about $500,000. What we are going to be doing is putting a timeout in place. This timeout is going to basically freeze the program that was passed through 3508, and it will be restarted in July 1st of 2011. And at this time, what we're also going to be doing is as follows. We will be repealing the remaining retro resentencing of inmates. What that means is anyone that's currently scheduled for a resentencing hearing upon the passage of this bill will no longer have that right to go forward. Those inmates that were resentenced are not going to be resentenced again. Whatever they received from the courts, if they received any additional time from the 10% that they requested, that stays in place. But we will not see any additional individuals that are potentially eligible for resentencing to go forward upon the passage of this bill and signed by the governor. By imposing the timeout until July 1, 2011, we will in fact do a couple of different things. We will be able to have the department, the Secretary of State's office conduct an audit. That audit, as we have stated, is going to go forward, and it will have basically three components to it. Did the Department of Corrections have compliance with its statutory law and the department's rules? Second, the evaluation of the actual or potential impacts of the program, both financially as well as the impact on recidivism and public safety. Third, using a literature review of the analysis of the best practices that are similar programs within the other states. Because this, there will be this timeout until July 1 of 2011, it will allow the legislature in 2011 to be able to take in the report. The goal is to have the report before the legislature by January 1 of 2011. That was the beginning of the session. We will have that report. We will be able to act with the understanding of what is in the report as to any modifications we believe are appropriate. What we will also be able to do is have an opportunity to make any other modifications that seem to be appropriate through that legislative process. The earned time program, when it continues in July of 2011, will have an expanded list of crimes that will include all person crimes. This is defined by the Criminal Justice Commission. We are picking up the additional crimes that were not included within the Criminal Justice Commission's definitions of person crimes that are currently in SB 1007. We're also picking up suggested other crimes that have been brought forward by the Oregon Anti-Crime Alliance. I will share with you, just for a visual, this represents the various crimes that are to be included, which are the person crimes, the list of those from Senate Bill 1007, as well as the list that Mr. Harker, Doug, thank you for, has given to us as consideration. What you will see is that what we believed of the four that we're putting together, 3508, will come to realization that we are, in fact, going to limit those individuals or those crimes that are has violence or a person or the distinct possibility to be excluded from the program. That will be in place based on the passage of this bill, so when it comes into effect, those who may be eligible today may not be eligible in the future because of the expansion of the list of exclusions. As I mentioned, the legislature will have the session in 2011 to take any other actions they may feel appropriate. We do have the emergency clause. The emergency clause, I believe, is important and essential to this bill so we can actually stop the hearings that are currently scheduled. My understanding that we have somewhere around 220 individuals that have been noticed by the Department of Corrections for possible hearings, with some of them starting up the end of this week. We also know that there's another 57 or more that have not been noticed that the Attorney General's office is reviewing as to what and when the notifications are required. I expect those individuals will also not be able to move forward based on the information I've received as to the type of crimes they have been involved in, and I believe that's what we have before us will in fact exclude them from being able to be considered for that additional time. Now, I want to make a couple other comments. When we put this together, the group of four, during the 2009 session, the intent was to make certain nonviolent crimes slash offenders were going to be considered, but not the ones that are much more egregious. Unfortunately, after as any large piece of legislation, we realized that we were not able to capture all the various charges and crimes that should have been on that list, and we're taking the steps today to do that. I want to also make certain that it's on the record. I personally believe that the Department of Corrections, through its earned time program, has been administering it appropriately over the past 20 years that it has been in existence. That doesn't mean that we could disagree with maybe an analysis on a particular inmate or a group of them, but I believe that the concept and the rules and the procedures that they have for operation has in fact been taken forward. But we do believe it's important that we have, as Mr. Doles requested, some type of audit, and we believe that it needs to be done outside of the Department of Corrections. Because of that, that's why we're asking that the Secretary of State do this. This will allow for a performance audit that they are very well attuned to be able to do, and they have this, the staffing to do it. I've spoken with the Secretary of State, and she has assured me that they will be able to put this into their work plan immediately, and it may mean that another one of the previous, let's say, preferred or other performance audits may not be able to happen immediately, but they are taking this and they will be moving exponentially to get this before us before the next session. And with that, we will in fact be able to take in consideration any other, let's say, modifications we may need. But I must say to this committee, and I want to say to all that are here and those that are listening, I do believe that the Department of Corrections has used their best efforts and judgments in administering the program. And we will always have those who may find a difference of opinion on a particular case or two, but as the integrity of the program itself, I do support them as it has been in represented to me that what they have been doing. Now, the last thing I want to make certain everyone understands that, yes, this program will continue. It is only a timeout. It will kick back in July of 2011, that we will in fact be able to, as a legislative body, make any of the modifications before that occurs. And most importantly, we're standing true to what was passed in 3508, the program itself that allows for those who are eligible to get the additional 10% will in fact continue to sunset in its entirety in 2013. The only way that's going to change, I want this on the record, is that it would take an affirmative vote of this legislature during the 2011 session to make any changes, because if not, it will in fact sunset as it has been, say, brought forward through 3508. So those are my comments. Any other comments, questions, discussion? Senator Boquist.
Just a question. So on the front page, I guess for council, it says this section changes from 20% to 30%. Section 2, amount of credits earned. Can you re-explain that in layman terms for me? So I understand that.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Section 1 is current law. That says 30%. Okay? You go over to page 2, notwithstanding the maximum time earned in this section may not exceed 20%. On page 2, right here. Line, page 2, line 4. Lines 3 and 4.
Correct. Follow up, Mr. Chair, just so I
yes.
clarify. The bold is 30%. So on the first page, it's changing something from 20% to 30%.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, yes, that's correct. But the current law is that they're eligible for 30%.
Right. So this is just a technical fix of something.
This is
revert back.
The Legislative Council, the way they formally started. Okay. I hope. the operative provision is, notwithstanding subsection A of this section, the maximum time credits earned under this section may not exceed 20% of the total term of incarceration. And then when you go into subsection A of the bill, what it is that's right. Okay, that would be on page here. Okay, first page, notwithstanding. Okay. Of this subsection.
Follow-up question, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Just so I clearly understand here, what I had proposed in the Dash 2 amendment was going back. This bill sort of does the same thing, but different time frames, and there's some different sorts of, I guess conceptually I grasp it, I think. Technical part of reading it, I'm not sure I understand it, but.
Regarding the Dash 2s, and I appreciate you giving me an opportunity to review them. My take on that is that we would not have an immediate stop to the program, that it would actually continue to go forward, and as it currently is passed or was passed in 3508 until July of this year. My concern is that is basically a four-month period. As I mentioned, we have potentially 277 individuals who could, in fact, go through this process. My review of the majority of those individuals did not fit the framework of the four work members, and that we felt that the way to keep them from being able to be considered for the potential additional 10%, as well as maintaining our desire not to require victims to have to come in and be in that process, especially where most of these individuals, they would not start realizing the savings on that additional time until sometime in the future. In fact, I've been told that at least a notice went out. I'm assuming it may be within the 220 for Lane County, that a person was not eligible to be released until 2053. That was not the intent of the work group, and so we figured what we need to do is put a stop immediately. That's why we have the emergency clause, and that's why we will basically repeal that, that part of the program that was passed in 3508, and we will, in fact, buy the time to have the audit, and we can actually have a little bit more information and actually deal with it before it kicks back in July of 2011.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And if there's an ability to, frankly, do what you just said, I think it's a good idea. When we were drafting the Dash 2, the only issue that came up was there was this constitutional issues that you
ex vel facto.
Right, you couldn't slam the brakes on, and, well, and we, this holds water, yeah. So to speak.
I would tell you this. We believe that based on the review of the literature of the cases that have come out of the federal courts, that this is a, unless someone was sentenced, or to say at the time they commit the crime, they had this as a potential, as a, then those individuals will in fact be able to get it. But those who were currently serving time that were not, had that as a benefit or a potential benefit at the time of the commission of the crime, it's the belief of the legislative council, in my review of their work, that federal ex facto would not apply because it's a right that we created afterwards and we're pulling back before it vests. And clearly, if it's been enumerated within an open court, either orally or in writing, that someone has received this benefit, then I would consider that as vested, and then that those individuals cannot be impacted. So we are taking the position of also reviewing the few cases that are close to being in this area involving the state system and the state constitution. We believe that the Oregon Supreme Court would also reach the same conclusion that the U.S. Supreme Court has already reached. Senator Wessett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple of questions. Does this Dash 4 amendment have a fiscal effect?
Well, we believe it will have some fiscal effect, and that gives a nice segue. Basically, the what's going to be happening at this point, we have received the authority to move this into Ways and Means. It will be going to Ways and Means from this committee, and my understanding is because of the desire to move this quick, that it may actually be before that committee tomorrow.
Second question, if I may, for Mr. Taylor. I thought I heard you indicate that the offenses that would under this law that would be not allowed to get a 30% reduction were the same list as the one in the original bill, but that list has 26 different offenses in the original bill, and it has significantly less than that in this bill.
No.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, what I tried, I probably didn't say clearly enough, the list within the bill as it relates to the look back, in other words, if someone committed a crime within a five-year period that was a Measure 11 crime or a crime listed in this bill, even if the crime that they're before the court now is eligible for earned time, they don't get it, okay? If they are before the court now for a crime and that they don't have a record and they're there for the first time and they're there for a crime that's on the list, they don't get the additional 10%. As far as the list that we saw in the original bill for the exclusion for the additional 10%, that's been considerably expanded as we've moved through this process.
Thank you for that explanation.
Yeah, and so I can hand out to you or to committee members, I'll get staff, I'll ask Mr. Taylor to please get to each of the members what is the components of that list that makes up. As I mentioned, it will be the person felonies as defined in statute that CJC has put together. That's basically this first page. And then what we did is we took the list that were within House Bill 3508, as well as those that were written in the Senate Bill 1007, and we've added those where they are not duplicated, meaning ones that are that stand alone from the person crimes. We've also taken the list that came from Doug Harker wrote on behalf of the Oregon Anti-Crime Alliance, and we've gone through there and we've picked up whatever crimes that are on that list that were not already picked up through any of the other list or from the person felony crimes that are there. So it's a very extensive list of exclusions. And I guess the other thing, and Bill has kind of given us the overview, and I'm going to refer to this as the bad due provision. Basically, what happens is if a person commits a crime, they will look back at 5 years from the time of the crime. It will be determined at that time as to whether or not the individual had been convicted of a crime that was not eligible for the additional 10%. If that's the case, they will not be eligible for the additional 10% because of the prior bad act. Also, for those who are coming out of, as you can imagine, many of these individuals could be coming out of prison, and so what you'll do is you'll have basically, upon release, if they had no provisions for post-prison supervision, which I don't think is going to happen, but post-prison supervision or parole, whichever of those have, in, when they end, you that 5 years would be from that point forward, 5 years, and if the crime committed within that period, they also would not be included. And so we're really narrowing down who would actually even be eligible for that. Other questions, comments? Senator Boquist.
Just a comment, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
I'm still only slightly confused, but that's all right. I think for the purposes of where we're going, at the moment, I'll support the Dash 4 amendment. I have concerns about knowing the details and how it comes out. I don't think I'll support the motion to send it Ways and Means, but I'll support the Dash 4 at this point.
Okay.
And it appears that you've wrapped a lot of the concerns that we've had together into this, and I'd ask that, you know, you allow staff to spend a little bit of time with me so when it comes out of wherever it comes out of, that I can understand it and I can actually explain it to my colleagues.
All right. Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to thank you for your work on this. I know that several of us had concerns about the implementation of 3508. As you may know, I went and visited some of the district attorneys in my district and observed some of the hearings, and I know that the counties were concerned particularly about the additional burden. That's behind us now, and I'm also glad that we have an opportunity to get some more data through the audits at the Secretary of State's office, and particularly looking forward to reviewing information about the effect of additional earned time on rates of recidivism. As we discussed in the public hearing on this bill last week, there is evidence that shows that additional earned time can actually decrease rates of recidivism. So I appreciate the opportunity to, instead of repealing the additional 10%, putting a freeze on it while we get that data, and I look forward to reviewing that. So I appreciate the opportunity and the work that you've done. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
The last thing I want to know, Senator, was it?
Procedural question, Mr. Chair. If this bill is referred from this committee to Ways and Means and then goes to the Senate floor, following that, will it go back to the Judiciary House Committee for further review, or will it go directly to the House floor?
I can't speak to that. I mean, traditionally, the way I think those things have worked is if they go to Ways and Means, they usually pop out and go to the or the floor or the chamber or the original chamber. I was going to say it wrong, so I'm not going to say that. Then it goes over to the other side. Now, Speaker Hunt, I guess, has it within his power to put it wherever he thinks he needs to put it. But normally, traditionally, it would go to the floors after it's gone through a Ways and Means process. That's correct.
Okay. Then I'm not at all certain that the Ways and Means Committee is the place to clean this bill up more if it needs to be cleaned up. That's my point.
Yeah. Well, the bottom line is we don't believe it needs to be cleaned up. We believe it's ready to go forward.
Okay. I appreciate that, Mr. Chair. At this point, if I had the opportunity or the ability, I would just simply abstain from this vote because I haven't had an opportunity to read this. I did support House Bill 3508, as you know. I think disappointed all of us in that it wasn't drafted to actually effectuate what we expected it to do. And this bill is a complete revamp. I've just seen it for a few minutes, and I won't support it until I've had time to read it.
I understand. So on the record, the amendments to the Dash 4s that are before the committee for consideration were handed to me this morning at about 8:26. And so as soon as I cleared the meeting that I received those in. That is when I brought them down, as I think, as you can attest. I first walked in and gave all the members ones, not knowing that council had already made copies.
Please don't construe that as attack on you, Mr. Chair. I know when you got them, I think it might have, it might make a comment on our ability to try to thoughtfully go about making laws in a 21-day session. But I fully respect that you didn't get them until a few minutes ago. I haven't had a chance to look at them.
And I appreciate that. I just want, this is, let's say, for the record, for those who may be listening and filling in the blanks. The other thing I want to make certain, and I want to thank the other members of the work group. Yes, I was a participant in that. Chair Barker was the House member for the policy side. We had three members of Ways and Means, Senator Verger, Senator Shields, and Representative Nathanson that were in the work group of five that have brought this product before us. So if there's no other questions at this point, any objections to the adoption of the Dash 4s into Senate Bill 1007? Senator Wissett objects. So ordered.
Motion to Ways and Means?
Well, it'd be a motion to the President's office with a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 1007 with the Dash 4 amendments.
With the
due pass recommendation, with a referral to the Senate President to refer it to Ways and Means, with the suggestion, with a direction to the Senate President's office to refer it to Ways and Means.
Senator Bonamici moves that we take House Senate Bill 1007 as amended by the Dash 4s and move it forward to the President's office with the due pass recommendation, with the request for a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. It's my understanding, and to that motion, do you have anything? To that motion, as Senator Wissett asked, will this have a financial impact? Clearly, there is going to be some loss and savings that was considered to be realized during this biennium that will, in fact, have an impact. And I do believe that the motion is appropriate to get it back before Ways and Means, for they can do a overview of it with any and everything else that they have before it. Senator Boquist.
Mr. Chair, just for a minute, I won't be supporting the bill right now, but after I've had time to review it and seen the Ways and Means process, I conceptually look forward to voting for this at a future time.
Thank you very much. Any other comments? Any objections to the motion? I have Senator Boquist, I have Senator Wissett. So ordered, since there are three supporting the motion. And that will close the work session of on Senate Bill 1007. And at this point, I believe the bill is on its way to staff, if you can get it to. All right. We're going to go ahead and open up a public hearing now on Senate Bill 999.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 999 was sponsored by Senate Veterans Affairs Committee. This bill comes to you from the Senate Veterans Affairs Committee, which Senator Boquist serves on. What this bill does, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it allows district attorneys greater discretion in referring members of the armed services or a veteran to supervise performance program if the referral is in the interest of justice and the benefit to the members of the armed services, the veterans, and the community. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, there is currently the power from the district attorney to put people in diversion programs as it relates to a certain series of crimes. This expands it for veterans. The rationale behind this is that the research now is almost overwhelming that people who come home, particularly from the military and combat, suffer psychological and physical changes, and that makes them relate different in society than they would have otherwise done so but for those circumstances. Chairman of the committee, you have two sets of amendments in front of you. The issue has come up as it relates to domestic violence, and you have a dash two amendments which limit the discretion of district attorneys by not allowing rape one, sodomy one and two, unlawful sexual penetration one and two, and sex abuse one from offers of diversion. Where it's discretionary with the district attorney, it was probably not likely in these crimes that they would offer diversion anyways. Then, as it relates to the Dash 2 amendments, it says basically you can have diversion if domestic, unless you've already had a prior conviction for a crime involving domestic relations, or you are currently subject to a an order, basically a domestic violence order. The Dash 4 amendments take a different approach. They have the same prohibition as to the same crimes, but basically say as it relates to domestic violence, the crime would have to occur before you were enlisted in the service, your prior conviction. And then what it also does, it basically says that in a diversion, the proceedings is basically stayed for a certain period of time. And if it's domestic relations, the diversion would be stayed, the process would be stayed for up to 36 months to 3 years. Sure that there are witnesses who want to testify.
Yeah, I just want to make sure you're finished.
I'm through.
All right, what I'm going to do is start with the panel. Let me make sure everyone understands. Today is set for public hearing and possible work session. I do not believe we're going to be able to do a work session today based on some comments I've heard. What I want to do is get as much, if not all of the testimony in, and I'm going to tell my committee now, I plan on staying a little bit longer. You do not need to stay for that part of the public hearing if you already have other schedule conflicts. With that, Jim Willis, Doug Harper-Rode, and Jess Barton. And gentlemen, what I'm going to ask is if you have written testimony, please do not read it into the record. We will read it for ourselves. It will be part of that. What we'd like for you to do is please summarize and give us the highlights. And I want to start off with Doug and Jess. I want to thank both of you for being part of the work group that I know that went on during the first part of the interim. And Jim, I believe you also were a part of that. So I want to thank all three of you for being willing to put that time in to bring the product forward. Whoever would like to start.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Jesse Barton. I'm an attorney in private practice here in Salem, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon War Veterans Association. OWVA was one of the four primary groups responsible for the drafting of this original bill. The others were the Oregon District Attorneys Association, the Oregon Anti-Crime Alliance, and the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. The original concept of the bill, Senate Bill 999, is what came out of the work group with those four membership organizations. The one change that came out that out of the House committee has to do with the type of, the diversion eligibility provision regarding the type of military discharge that would make a service member ineligible for the diversion program. But what I want to start, though, more is to talk about currently, a veteran, for example, could seek diversion through sentencing once he's been convicted of a crime, but the idea that we have here is to try to avoid prosecution altogether for service members charged with certain crimes. That was the whole concept behind Senate Bill 999. Once a person goes through the diversion program as it existed for however many years, since 1995 as I understand it, the person succeeds with the diversion program, any criminal charges against him will be dismissed with prejudice. I want to mention that, you see in my written materials, I quote ORS 135896. That statute states that when a person enters into the diversion program, the diversion program cannot exceed 270 days if the crime's a felony and 180 days if the crime's a misdemeanor. I want to mention that now because I want to come back to that in a minute, because one of the amendments in our Dash 4, one of the amendments in the Dash 4 amendments has to do with that length of the stay for a service member who enters a diversion program. The bill as it's written now does prohibit participation in the diversion program for the felony sex crimes that Mr. Taylor enumerated. But in addition to that, also persons charged with crimes that are Class A or B felonies and where the crime involves physical injury as defined in the criminal code. You'll see the definition of physical injury at the bottom of the first page of my materials. If you're charged with a if a service member's charged with a Class A or a B felony that involves physical injury, the service member is not eligible for the diversion program. If it's a Class C felony or if it's an unclassified felony that involves serious physical injury, and the definition of that is at the top of page 2 of my materials, then the service member is not eligible for the diversion program. The bill defines service member very broadly. It defines it not only in terms of persons who are on active reserve or National Guard service currently, but also persons who are veterans in the sense that they previously were on active duty guard or reserve service. There are five types of military discharges. Those are listed on page 2 of my materials, and then at the back of my materials there's an article that was issued by a JAG officer in the Air Force that describes in more detail the five types of discharges. But persons discharged from the military with bad conduct discharges or dishonorable discharges would be ineligible for diversion under the amendments that went into the bill, that made the bill into, well, actually were the Dash 1 amendments that transformed the bill into the A engrossed version. District attorneys will be able to set their own additional criteria for when to apply or when to admit service members into a diversion program, so long as the criteria that they create are permissible criteria, meaning basically they can't be arbitrary, meaning that they can't be based on, or they're arbitrary in the sense they can't be based on classifications such as race or sex, and so long as the district attorney's office consistently applies the eligibility criteria that are based, the permissible eligibility criteria. The 36 individual district attorney offices around the state will be able to create their own individual criteria for determining when a service member is admitted into a diversion program. The Dash 4 amendments, which I've actually not seen, Mr. Chairman, I understand they are available. I heard from Joshua Nasby at Legislative Council that they're out, but I spoke with him about these yesterday. These actually are the Dash 3 amendments, which the Oregon War Veterans Association had worked on previously, plus one additional matter, but I'll go through those. Those are actually, I've enumerated those toward the bottom of page 2 of my materials, but first, again, we agree with the other folks on this bill that the felony sex crimes that Mr. Taylor previously identified should be excluded from diversion eligibility. The second amendment would change the stay period for service members who enter the diversion program when it involves a crime of domestic violence, but would change the stay period from 180 days for misdemeanors, 270 days for felonies, to 3 years for all cases. But I understand from talking with representatives from the Oregon District Attorneys Association, there could be funding problems with that regarding community corrections. And so that may be a problem. I don't know. I just wanted to alert the committee to that potential problem. The third amendment that's in the Dash 4 amendments is a requirement that district attorney's offices, in domestic violence cases, district attorney offices give crime victims adequate notification of the intent to enter into a diversion program so that the crime victims can have an opportunity to be heard on whether or not the service member should be admitted into a diversion program. And then the fourth amendment is that service members would be ineligible for a diversion program if they're charged with a crime of domestic violence and they previously had incurred a conviction for a crime of domestic violence prior to the time they became a service member, so prior to their entry into the military. The concept there is that if a person committed a domestic violence crime before they ever entered the military, it stands to reason that the service member's domestic violence activities have nothing to do with the fact that he was ever in the military. But conversely, if a person never committed crimes of domestic violence before they entered the military, but then begin to commit domestic violence crimes after they are released from the military, and this is unfortunate, but it's something that happens with some frequency, persons serving multiple deployments who incur traumatic brain injury, for example, can have difficulties readjusting to civilian life. They've been programmed to be warriors, and now they have to be civilians, and without adequate reprogramming upon entry or re-entry into civilian world, we can see it's very plausible to see crimes of domestic violence being committed. If those crimes of domestic violence were never committed until after the person entered the military, then there's a good plausibility that the commission of domestic violence crimes is somehow related to military service. But one point we want to make, though, is that we're not saying that a person who has prior domestic violence convictions that the service member incurred after entry into the military should be allowed onto diversion. We're not saying that. We're saying that the district attorney's office should have the discretion to allow the person into diversion. The district attorney's office may choose not to do so. The district attorney's office might give, will be required to give notice to the crime victims of the fact that the DA's office is investigating the possibility of a diversion program. And the crime victims may come forward and say, no, don't let that person into a diversion program. We want him prosecuted. Or if you're going to let him into a diversion program, do it, but do it in this particular way that impose certain conditions that perhaps the district attorney's office hasn't previously considered. There are also some, have been raised some concerns about the constitutionality of this bill, the fact that it allows diversion for service members but not for anyone else. There's a January 11th, 2010 opinion of Legislative Council which pretty much concludes that there are no constitutional defects with the bill. The Oregon War Veterans Association is adamant that there are no constitutional defects with the bill. The case law that I provided on page 3 of my materials, there's just some basic case law establishing that, for example, that under the Oregon Constitution, the courts have consistently rejected challenges to statutes as being discriminatory when the statutes themselves created the alleged class, the class being service members. That's a case called McPherson versus Department of Administrative Services. The United States Supreme Court has similarly recognized that there's nothing irrational about giving service members special treatment. That's why there are special programs available for service members or for veterans, because of the commitment and the sacrifice that veterans previously have provided their country. So that, Mr. Chairman, I think completes my presentation on the bill.
Thank you very much. Doug or Jim, whoever wants to go next.
Why don't I go next? I'll be fairly short, Chair Pruzanski, members of the committee. I want to tell you a quick story about Bo O'Rummel, boatsman's mate, second class. From 2002 to 2005, he was awarded the United States Coast Guard Achievement Medal. This man made a record 110. Wartime boarding, seizing tons and tons of cocaine, illegal oil. He operated in Iraqi freedom. Now I want to tell you about one of the best days of my life as district attorney in Lane County. That was in 2002 to 2005. In 2001, I got a phone call from Mr. Rummel's, Bo Rummel's dad. I knew this family a little bit from high school days. He said, my kid has been arrested, and I think it's a felony. I think I was driving this direction, actually, from Lane County. Asked one of my senior lawyers to look at it, Paul Grabner. He said, it's perfect for our felony diversion program, Doug. This kid beat up a car, $1,500 in damage, criminal mischief in the first degree. He's in the Coast Guard in 2001, and we ought to put him in. So we put him in. He did our correspondence course. Senator Pruzanski knows all about this program. Seems goofy. It has incredible statistical success for both misdemeanors and felonies. And that's an analysis by each and every individual that did it, over 1,700 of them. All right. His supervising officer volunteered to fly up from San Diego, where he was based, and bring him home, back down to school. He went down there, he did the program, he succeeded, and because he did that, he stayed in the Coast Guard of the United States rather than getting kicked out. He received that Superior Performance Award, and then the better day, one of the better days of my district attorney's life is years later, Bo Rummel makes an appointment to come see me. And he brings me one of his medals, and he wants me to have it. And he brings me a flag that flew over one of the ships that he was on when he was doing those dangerous boardings. And he wanted me to have it. He thinks that because we put him through that program, his life changed dramatically. And so how does all this relate to this diversion program in front of you today? We need to do this so we have more Bo Rummels. That's all I have.
Thank you, Chair Pruszynski, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jim Willis. I'm director of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. I believe Jess has laid out pretty well the reasons why we believe this bill is important. In addition to PTSD and traumatic brain injury, I do want to offer the fact that those who have been in combat and are coming home today also sometimes rely on either illegal or prescriptive drugs and or alcoholic beverages. And that leads to some of their conduct, which brings them into the criminal justice system. So let me end my remarks, Mr. Chair, by talking about what are the resources that we can count on should these diversions take place, especially through the United States Department of Veterans Affairs. Just 7 days ago, their 2011 budget was released. That budget was $125 million. Of that $125 billion, of that amount, $5.2 billion is dedicated for mental health treatment. And that represents an 8.5% increase over current spending. It is a recognition by the federal VA, along with their state and local partners, that we need to do more for this generation of veterans. One-fifth of the entire veteran population seen by the federal VA health system, which is about 7 million veterans, a full fifth of those had a mental health diagnosis. And so as a result, the VA has added 6,000 new mental health professionals since 2005, and they have a total of 19,000 employees who deal solely with mental health issues, which of course would be part of what we would be addressing with this bill. They have pledged to continue to expand their program to deal with PTSD and traumatic brain injury, along with the diagnosis and treatment of depression, substance abuse, and other mental health problems. Secretary Shinseki of the federal VA has called PTSD treatment central to the VA's mission. So clearly, those of us who are veterans advocates, our mental health professional partners, certainly the prosecutors and our defense bar, are united in understanding that something needs to be done. We need to have this tool in the toolbox to get these things done, and then we need to know that when these diversions take place, that the resources are available to assist these veterans. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any questions for the panel? Request.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just brief question for any member of the panel, because all three of you are quite more familiar with the bill than the rest of us sitting up here, and I went through another hearing. A2, A4, I mean, they're trying to address a domestic issue that was raised by members of the House Committee and was actually raised in the Veterans Committee. Can you briefly comment on the A2 and the A4, because they are, for better word, competing?
And Mr. Chairman, Senator Boak, was the A4, well, the A2 amendments were the first concept brought forward addressing domestic violence concerns. It would exclude from eligibility persons charged with a domestic violence crime and who either have a prior domestic violence crime conviction. Actually, this is not in the bill right now. It was supposed to have been in the bill. It was omitted inadvertently. But there's supposed to be a five-year cutoff to say that if you have if a service member is charged with a domestic violence crime and has a prior conviction for a domestic violence crime within the previous 5 years, that service member would be ineligible for diversion. Or if the service member is charged with a domestic violence crime and has a restraining order against him that was issued or obtained by the same victim as the as exists in the present case, then the service member would be ineligible for diversion. What the Dash 4 amendments do instead is it provides, well, actually two things. First, it requires notice be given to the victim. It requires the district attorney's office to give notice to the victim of the district attorney's office interest in diverting the case so that the victim can have an opportunity to be heard on whether diversion should be allowed or under what conditions it should be allowed. And then the second thing it does is it cuts off diversion eligibility for a service member charged with a domestic violence crime and who has a prior conviction for a domestic violence crime that was entered before the service member ever became a service member. So while he was still what I call a pure civilian, establishing that he was that service member was a person prone to domestic violence conduct before he ever entered the military, and establishing that his military service has potentially probably nothing to do with the fact that he ever committed crimes of domestic violence.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right, thank you. Any other questions? Doug, real quick, please.
Very quick comment. The way I think this is actually going to work in the offices of the district attorneys is that they're going to set up a program in conjunction probably with the defense bar and the veterans folks in their community. The defendant's going to have to plead guilty, and then that's going to go in abeyance while the program operates. And so if the person flunks out, they're just going to get sentenced. There's going to be no trial. They're just going to get sentenced. I mean, that's the way I'd set this program up. It's the way I've set these programs up in the past. And the real key to this is the treatment. And that's why I'm so pleased to hear about all the treatment capabilities here of the Veterans Affairs folks. That's the way it's going to work. So what I don't want you to do is squeeze the statute down too much so that the DA doesn't get to look at some offenders. Now, I'm fine taking out all those sex cases. No DA in their right mind is going to do that anyway.
Doug, let me ask you, based on the work group, because I had this conversation with Jess, because that's how I do my diversions in court. We basically have the judge signs off, and they have to actually plead guilty or no contest, and the judge accepts it at that point. Was it intended that anyone coming into this program statewide would have to go through that process, or is that still going to be open for each of the district attorney's offices to make the decision as to whether or not they're going to have an upfront plea?
It's at the discretion of the district attorney, just as it is now, and just as you would have that discretion if you decided to do that.
Right.
Okay.
I just have a quick question.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your testimony. Just out of curiosity, is it the victim noticed, absent this provision, there's a specific provision requiring that the victim be noticed before diversion agreement. What if this isn't in law? Isn't the victim noticed anyway before diversion agreement?
I think it's already there because they're charged with a crime, and so then the normal victim's rights already kick in.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you all very much. My next panel is going to include Christine Herman, Colin Cochran, and Sybil Hebb. And again, for each of you, if you have written testimony, please don't try to read it in the record. Just give us a summary and highlights. Realize that we're not moving the bill today, and there's been an opportunity to maybe make some adjustments between now and Thursday.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Sybil Hebb for the Oregon Law Center, as well as the Legislative Alliance to End Violence Against Women, here today to present testimony regarding Senate Bill 999. I spent some time in my testimony and my written comments summarizing what I understood were the Dash 2 and the Dash 3 amendments. We've just looked at the Dash 4s, and I think I'll confine my comments to the policies and the principles here. Working with victims of domestic and sexual violence, we're very concerned about the message that the criminal justice system sends to society, as well as to offenders and to victims, about the importance and the severity of those crimes. We know that in Oregon, domestic and sexual violence are serious public health and safety problems. We see the impact in the child welfare system. Nearly a third of child abuse cases are as a result of domestic violence in the home. We know that 33% of domestic violence incidences are witnessed by children. And we know, unfortunately, and all too recently, have seen great evidence of the fact that these crimes can be fatal. We saw 18 people lose their lives in the last 2 months of 2009 alone. Two of those victims were children who were shot by parents. And so I just want to draw brief attention to the fact that this is an incredibly serious problem in Oregon and nationally, and the criminal justice system's response to that problem does have a major impact on how society views the issue. I don't deny that service members suffer great trauma, and we very much respect their service and don't in any way mean our criticism of the bill to be a criticism of service members. We are concerned about the bill if it moves forward without an exemption for domestic violence crimes, especially for repeat offenders. We designed the A2 amendments to try to provide a balance between what we understand to be the difficult circumstances that veterans suffer and the importance of diversion in some circumstances with the very real impact that domestic violence has on family members in the home. And we believe that the Dash 2s get at only repeat offenders, people who've had prior convictions. Just Mr. Barton mentioned that we had intended that preclusion to be limited to convictions that had taken place within the last 5 years, and that was, it didn't show up in the amendments, but we did intend that to be there. And that was meant to be a reasonable sort of, if it's a recent issue and it's a conviction of an assault against a family member, and now the person is back in the criminal justice system with another charge of assault against a family member, that's a problem. And it's an indicator of lethality that advocates look at when they're trying to determine how dangerous is this situation. Repeat offenses are an indicator. And we also think that, you know, if it's a repeat offense and the conviction was in the last 5 years, then the person probably had an attempt or a chance at diversion in the processing of that prior offense. And so the Dash 2s are crafted to try to be getting at that specific category of folks who are already have already had some interaction with the court system and some violence against a family member. The Dash 4s, although I haven't seen them, I think I understand them well enough to say that the concerns that we have are, I think, threefold. One is that extending the length of a diversion program from the victim perspective doesn't necessarily accomplish good. Lengthening the time of a diversion program, if the guilty plea was not entered as a prerequisite, only makes it harder potentially for the DA to bring the charge 3 years down the line than it would have been had the decision about whether to move forward or not had to have been made closer in time to the crime. So if there's a conviction or a guilty plea that's required at the beginning of a diversion program, then that's some incentive for the defendant or the alleged offender to participate in the treatment programs. That's really important, especially when there isn't supervision funding for adequate sort of look-see at how things are going. And what we worry about is that that's a longer period of time within which really the onus of determining whether or not the defendant is complying falls really on the victim, who is a family member and in a very compromised position, as you might imagine, in terms of making determinations about what should happen next to that offender. And so we worry about the burden that the Dash 4s put on the family members. The other concern that we have is that many of the treatment programs that we know of vary in terms of their quality and ability to really address domestic violence-specific issues. We appreciate the many resources that the Veterans Association has and brings to the table, but I think the issue of domestic violence intervention is one that is new to many agencies, including the VA, and so we're worried about whether the treatment programs really are available for that specific issue. And I guess I would just say to the additional provision of the Dash 4s that a conviction prior to the service would be an excluder. I think we appreciate what their, you know, the effort that they brought into this amendment, but I don't think that there's an appropriate enough or close enough connection. That could be many, many years ago. There could be offenses that had taken place or restraining orders or protection orders that had been entered closer in time to this charge that we're considering now, and it's not a clear connector that service equals domestic violence perpetration. And if there was a causal connection there, it might be more appropriate to have the excluder be a conviction that happened prior to service, but we don't feel that that's an appropriate protector. And I guess I would just sum up by saying we do appreciate the work that's gone into this and the committee's attention to this issue, and just think that if we're excluding things like driving while under the influence from diversion, except in certain very specific circumstances, if by not failing to give the same attention to domestic violence, which is just as pervasive, if not more so, unfortunately, crime against the very fabric of our societies, our families, I think that that's a mistake. So I appreciate your time.
All right, thank you. Whoever wants to go next.
Senator Przanski and members of the committee, my name is Christine Herman. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Sexual Assault Task Force. We're a private nonprofit agency. And I wanted to just take a moment to thank the drafters of this bill for their willingness to exclude the sex crimes that have been mentioned. I think that was not an issue when it was brought up, and I appreciate their willingness to amend the bill to do that. I also am in support of the Dash 2 amendments for many of the reasons that Ms. Hebb just mentioned. Also, I would note that one of the primary differences between the Dash 2 and the Dash 4 amendments is the Dash 2 would exempt or accept from the diversion process anyone who's currently subject to a restraining order against a victim of the current crime, something that's not included in the Dash 4 amendments. And as we know, most domestic violence crimes are not reported and not, therefore, subject to conviction, but there are many more civil restraining orders that are issued that would indicate a pattern of violence and that that might be absent in a criminal record. So, we also want to thank the drafters of the bill for the effort that they've put into this. It is a worthy cause, and we're definitely supportive of allowing options for veterans to get treatment services. So, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Colin Cochran, and I represent the Oregon Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence, and my prepared testimony would only serve to reiterate the excellent testimony that my fellow panelists just gave, so I'll keep it short. And just to say that my organization has been around since 1978 working to protect victims of sexual and domestic violence, and SB 999 with the Dash 2 amendments recognizes the severity of domestic and sexual violence in the state of Oregon and takes steps to protect those victims who we work with every single day. So we respectfully urge your strong support for SB 999-2. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Any questions from anyone on the panel? Thank you all very much for coming forward. The last panel I have that's signed up is going to be including Gail Meyer, Brigadier General Mike Caldwell, and Brad Berry. While they're coming up, is there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today that did not sign up on the list? And just to let you know, I do have members who have to leave, so don't think they're leaving because you just came up to the table. Thank you. Are you fine? Thank you. No. General?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, Brigadier General Mike Caldwell, I'm Deputy Director of the Military Department, and you want to keep it short, I'll keep it short. We support the Dash 4, and we support the effort that the committee and the drafters have made to make this thing happen. So appreciate your support.
Thank you. Gail, I'll take
thank
you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Gail Meyer, on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, we also support the Dash 4. We were at the table, part of the consensus group from the beginning, and I think it's fair to say that we all anticipated that the beachhead of where these assault of violent tendencies might first present themselves was in the home. We didn't anticipate it would only be bar fights or road rage. And I would like to say that I think that the Dash 4 gives maximal discretion to the district attorney, and I would submit also maximal respect to the victim. There would be plenty spousal members who would want maximal treatment for their spouse. There would be those two who would object to it, and I'm sure the district attorney would yield to those points of view. So we like the idea of giving maximal discretion here.
Thank you. Brad?
Thank you. For the record, my name is Brad Berry. I'm Yamhill County District Attorney, and I chair the Oregon District Attorneys Association Legislative Committee. First, Chair Przanski and members of the committee, I want to thank this work group for involving the DAs from day one. I think it's important to note that diversions typically have not been allowed for cases involving physical violence. And really what this bill does is expand that, recognizing that these men and women who return from the service, who return from war, certainly have issues that can come about which cause them to react in a violent way or in a physical way just with their training. And so we recognize the expansion of the that Senate Bill 999 does to allow for physical injury cases that we otherwise wouldn't have. If I might, I mentioned to Chair Brzezinski that we too would concur with the Dash 2 amendments. I think this is consistent with the approach that this state has taken, recognizing that domestic violence cases are different, that they do reach the fabric of our homes, and that a one-time exemption, which this would allow, you could have diversion for a single domestic violence incident, may be appropriate in light of the circumstances and facts put before the district attorney, but beyond that, probably would not be appropriate. And I would, I recognize that the Dash 4, although I too have not seen it, would say that if you have the prior, which occurred before the service, that that then would preclude you from a diversion. And I just offer this as a question. I know that many men and women who enter the service go in at 18, 19, 20 years of age. Most domestic violence offenders are older than that at the time they become before the system. So really, it's difficult to say, is it a result of the service or is it something that would have come about otherwise? And I'm just anecdotally, in my county, we rarely have domestic violence offenders who are younger than that age anyway. A couple other observations that I would like to just to put for you, because it causes some concern. In the Dash 3 and Dash 4, again, as I understand the Dash 4, there is the requirement that the district attorney notify the victim in the case. I would caution this committee from expanding the notification requirements to district attorneys on victims. As you are well aware, the requirements on DA offices currently is tremendous on what we have to do with victims. We already have a requirement in felony cases to consult with the victim on any plea negotiation. I would tell you that in almost all domestic violence cases, we in fact do consult with the victims regardless of the offense, but to make that requirement specific, I do not think is necessary and is an unnecessary expansion of duties on the DA offices. The last thing I want to point out is pragmatic. In my expectation in a case like this would be that these cases would be supervised or monitored by community corrections. And that poses a problem in a couple of ways. First, on a diversion, or as described by I think Senator Brzezinski and Mr. Harkle wrote, on a diversion, there's no judgment entered. And whether it's a felony or not, or a misdemeanor, corrections without a judgment of conviction is not paid for that supervision. The DA offices don't have the ability to supervise these offenders and to see whether or not they have completed the obligations of the diversion itself. More in particular, on any misdemeanor, even with the entry of a judgment, corrections is not paid to monitor those offenders. Many, if not most, community corrections offices in the state, even though not funded to monitor supervision of misdemeanors, do so in two particular areas. One is driving under the influence, and the second being domestic violence, both of which you can see or recognize in this state as particular offenses which pose significant public safety risks. And I think that the community corrections offices in most counties recognize that supervision poses a great benefit to the community. The last thing I wanted to mention in the Dash 3 and Dash 4, the potential for a diversion of up to 3 years, of course, exacerbates the particular issue of extended diversion without funding to community corrections. So I offer that more as I think it poses issues, I think, for the counties, it poses issues for the district attorneys that are not necessarily addressed. The one last thing I want to mention on the three-year is that when we talk about domestic violence offenses, domestic violence counseling typically takes a minimum of 52 weeks. Currently, a 270-day on a felony or 180 days on a misdemeanor would be insufficient time for an offender on a domestic violence case to complete treatment. That assumes getting into treatment the day that they're before the court, and that, of course, doesn't happen typically. So there does need to be something in there which which, assuming that the committee wants to allow diversions on domestic violence cases, we can debate whether there's a prior or not. We need to have some flexibility to expand that beyond the 270 or 180-day minimum, but going to 3 years, I think, poses a funding issue for community corrections in particular.
All right. Brad, if this stays open as broad as it seems to be, in the sense of each district attorney is going to be able to determine what they're willing to offer to the defendant for a diversion, do you think having that as an outside window, in other words, I wouldn't expect that they would all be for 3 years, but would give the latitude. Now, clearly that may still be too long. I agree with you. I know for the court, the ones that we use for domestic violence, it's a 52-week program. I guess it's pretty standardized statewide. Mm-hmm. And so we know we need to have at least a year. So what I'm going to do is this. I'm going to open up for questions, but I am going to let everyone know that I'm going to have Mr. Taylor meet with those who are interested. We've got one shot to get some additional amendments in trying to modify this. This bill has to come out of this committee on Thursday. If it doesn't come out on Thursday, it doesn't make it. And so time is of the essence, and I expect that those who are interested are going to be there to give constructive input, and we can get something to LC hopefully by the end of today so we can make sure we make that timeline. Any questions for anyone on this panel? Thank you all very much for coming forward. And Greg, I'm going to give you a couple of minutes to just wrap up, but I've already got committee members here 20 minutes beyond what I've asked.
Thank you, Chair Przanski and members of the committee. My name is Greg Warnock, Oregon War Veterans Association. A couple of things. I wanted to point out that this is a veterans bill, and the purpose of it is to provide an opportunity for veterans to receive treatment for their disorders relating to their military service. And we have compromised over and over and continue to look at possibilities for compromise to help all the parties involved. I would like to state, though, that we've been working on this since last session, beginning of last session, and we pulled together some very good teams of people, including the reintegration team, Department of Veterans Affairs, military department, the DAs, we've invited the domestic violence advocates. Oregon War Vets has been since the beginning involved in this. And so there's been a lot of input. We came to this legislature, this session, prepared to present a bill that everybody approved of. Since we put it on the table, there have been a lot of other people desiring to be involved in the concept and in the conversation. We've enabled them to do that. We've continued the discussion with them, and I think we've been pretty open to them for the most part. We've accommodated also. The three-year period of time is based on the fact that there may be reoffenses, that if somebody's involved in a problem with domestic violence, we want to make sure those people get treatment. The three-year period is to enable them to get treatment. It's not really about legal issues. It's about treatment issues. And we want to make sure that they stay in the program long enough to be treated and to have their treatment completed. So that's the reason why we came up with a three-year period of time. We don't believe that community corrections needs to be involved at all. Right now, most misdemeanors aren't even dealing with community corrections. So that's something that I think is irrelevant in this conversation. The Department of Veterans Affairs, the treatment programs that are going to be established that we're working on right now very diligently to develop, they will be the overseers of these offenders and making sure that they get the treatment that they require. So some of the conversations that have occurred just today have been discussed in the past, but the treatment programs will take care of a lot of that. We are very concerned about domestic violence and the problems, the huge problem that brings to our society. However, here's our point. I want to make it really clear, and I'll finish with this, that at the statute level, we believe that the statute needs to be as broad as possible to enable everybody who's a veteran or a service member to be at least considered for a diversion program, unless they're already excluded, as we've agreed to some exclusions. The domestic violence issues, we believe that the DV advocates are so well organized
more than the veterans organizations, to provide counsel to the DAs about whether or not a person should or should not be involved in the diversion program. Veterans advocates will not always be available, because of our resources, to be at those meetings, those hearings, when a veteran's involved in a criminal activity. But the DV advocates are very, very good about making sure the DAs are aware of whether or not that person is likely to reoffend or if they have additional problems. So we want to leave it as broad as possible so the DAs have full authority, which, by the way, was one of our compromises. We wanted judges to do it, not the DAs.
Need you to wrap it up.
I'm sorry?
Need you to wrap up.
So, thank you. So our point is we want it to be as broad as possible at the statute level and let us work with the DV advocates to help the DAs develop policies that will be appropriate for the DV situations. Thank you very much.
Any questions? All right. I want to thank you for coming forward and everyone else who's come forward. I know this is somewhat rushed, but realize that we're in an expedited hearing mode because of the time deadlines that we have. It is the chair's intent to move something on Thursday. And again, for those who want to work with Mr. Taylor, need to be meeting with him immediately so they can set up a expedited schedule for that to occur. And then we will bring this bill back. I'm carrying it over until Thursday of this week. Senate Bill 999 will be carried over until what will be, I guess, will be Thursday, February 11th. Anything else from members? If not, I want to thank you very much for being here and staying the additional time. With that, we're adjourned.